Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is a former foreign correspondent for Reuters, the BBC and the Financial Times. Reporting predominantly from Africa, she's also written a number of books. Her latest book, Do Not Disturb, the story of a political murder and an African regime gone bad, focuses on Rwanda and its lurch towards authoritarianism. Michaela Wrong, welcome to Meet the Writers.
It's a pleasure.
We have to kind of explain the context here because we are still in lockdown Britain. We're sitting in my garden and it feels like spring is finally here. And I'm saying that in case there's kind of wild dog barking or any other kind of odd noises. But it feels very far away from Africa, which is a place we're both really invested in. And at the same time, I feel that everything you've written here makes it so present. This book, and indeed your entire kind of canon, has been so informative to me, and I'm sure to so many people who don't know the continent in any way. What was your first connection with Africa?
I went out to Côte d'Ivoire, Abidjan, as a Reuters correspondent, and that was my first proper encounter with Africa. And it was just a little taster. I only did that for 9 months and then I resigned from Reuters and tried another job, which was a complete failure. And I think that was a marvellous taste because I was in West Africa and with this license to roam, ended up covering a coup in Sierra Leone, going to Chad, Senegal. And I think, you know, anyone who hasn't been to Africa, it's just Africa's this sort of very, this huge label, this large name that sort of has these vague connotations and echoes which you don't really understand. And of course, once you start traveling, you begin to see how each country is completely different from the other one and how you will never get them mixed up again and how each has its own history and its very and its particularities. And so I think I got the bug then, but it was a slow burn. I often get asked by people, oh, you know, when did you fall in love with Africa? And I always find that strange because I think that's asked about Africa, but it's not asked about other places. Mm. It's almost as though, oh, well, you can only possibly explain why you would be covering Africa for so long because you had some sort of weird fixation, a crush on the place, an infatuation. And it wasn't like that. I mean, I think it's more a case of once you start writing about a place as a journalist and researching it, traveling around, you begin to know these stories and you form bonds with the people you interview. And then you see how things change and often change very dramatically. And then you want to write about what you know. And so one of the really rewarding things is that all these decades later, because it really is, I think it's about 25 years I've been writing about Africa now, which is horrifying to me. But, I'm writing about places that I've been visiting and traveling to and people that I've known a very long time. And so you've known them long enough to see this trajectory. And the latest book is about somebody I met for the first time in 1994, Patrick Karagaya, the head of intelligence. And then seeing what happened to him in 2014, where he was murdered by his own regime and by his old friend, Paul Kagame, on his orders. And you only see that trajectory because you've remained invested in the continent. So there's something very rewarding about following something for that length of time. Mm. It just means that, you know, you're watching something unfold and it becomes more and more fascinating to you.
Because your family connection was with Italy, in fact.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I have no family connection with Africa. Well, I say that, but there is a very distant great aunt called Marga Wrong, who I don't know that much about, but she was on the Canadian side of my family, and she's buried in Gulu. And she died doing this work. She was committed to spreading literacy around Africa. And it was very touching because I went to visit her grave in Gulu one time in northern Uganda. And it's a very simple grave. And I sort of thought, oh, so I do have some connection with this place after all. I mean, I have some personal family connection. But, you know, this is a woman who died in, I think it was 1940s. I never met her. Don't know that much about her. For me, the family history that matters is I'm very connected with Oxford, where my father's family came from, and my mother is from the north of Italy, a Protestant Italian, which is a whole thing in itself. It's a bit like being a British Catholic, small, rather beleaguered, persecuted minority in her time. So those are the stories I knew growing up, but there was no family connection with Africa.
Tell me about the name Wrong.
Wrong, yes. Well, obviously, if you're a journalist, it's not great to have the surname Wrong. And when I joined Reuters in the 1980s, I remember that, after I'd got in, our training editor, this marvellous man called George Short, he took me to one side and he said, we did wonder whether we should get you to change your surname, just have a nom de plume. And I said, well, I don't mind. I mean, I'll do that if you feel it's necessary. He said, no, we thought probably it'll be easier for people to remember it, So I remained with it. And, it's something that you're constantly teased about when you're a child, a constant mocking in the playground. And I think in a way it's quite good. It makes you a little bit tougher. Mm-hmm. And it's quite funny because, of course, now I'm being trolled all the time on Twitter. And I always notice that one of the main things that they seize upon is my surname. She's wrong. She's living up to her name. What does she know? She's a liar. And I think, I've been hearing that joke since I was five. It doesn't hurt anymore.
Despite the family connection to Oxford, you in fact went to Cambridge.
Yeah, that was a deliberate thing because I had a granny who actually taught history to postgraduate students. She was connected to one of the colleges well into her 80s. And she was a redoubtable woman, really was. And I associated Oxford with visiting her, with my father, as children in this drafty, cold, it was always freezing cold, dark basement that she lived in. And I just wanted to sort of break away from those memories and do my own thing, and not have that Oxford legacy that came with my father's family.
So why then journalism?
I sort of always vaguely knew I'd do something in the future that had that was connected with writing. I was one of those pupils who your teachers sort of said, "Oh, you write quite well," and I remember other people at my school would sort of borrow my essays, and so it always came easily to me, and it always was something pleasurable. It was my way of sort of understanding the world. If you write it down, you can remember it. And I think I was a lonely child, a loner, and so I read enormously. I mean, I just read and read and read things that were probably far too old for me often. And my mother was a great one for taking us to the library and, coming back with a sort of huge stack loads of books, which we would read and then return to the library, get a new stack load. So I think that was just the sort of world in which you grew up, and then growing up reading the magazines that they read and just sort of thinking, well, whatever I do, I'll end up writing, But I didn't know in what way.
We've talked about the beginning of your journalistic career in Africa, but your first, or perhaps your second sort of residential post, if you like, was in what we now know as DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, which was then Zaire.
Yeah. And actually, I only went there because I'd lost my job. I was working on the Sunday Times and my contract was not renewed. And I was quite desperate, actually. I didn't have a job. I wasn't earning anything. It was the first time that I'd ever been out of work. And so I rang up my old employer, Reuters, and I said, well, where do you have any... I'd like to be a stringer. I didn't want to go back into Reuters' corporate structure. I said, I'd like to be a stringer. Where do you have... I'd like to try Africa again. This was after my time in Ivory Coast. And where do you have any postings? And they suggested Zaire. And I had enough connotations with Mobutu Zaire to sort of go, well, do you have anywhere else? And my future boss said, no, that's where we need someone right now. And so I didn't really have a choice. And so I went there. And in fact, it was a very rewarding time for me. I would have happily stayed longer. I ended up only doing a year then and jumping into the FT and moving to Nairobi, but it was a very it was a very good experience. I think one of the things I really enjoyed was that feeling of being on a story, and there was only me and someone from AFP covering, you know, from the agencies, covering events, really. And it, you know, to have that sort of directness, you know, if you didn't see something, if you didn't interview someone, it sort of hadn't happened. And it was a world of journalism where you weren't waiting for someone to send you a press release or, you know, to have the story half written for you by some flack, you know, working for a minister. There was none of that. It was like, it was pure journalism. And that was terribly rewarding and great fun, of course.
Out of that came your first book, In the Footsteps of Mr. Kurtz, which introduced me to your writing and has made me a fan ever since, and made sure that I've read absolutely everything else, with its nod to Heart of Darkness and Conrad and all the rest of it. It's an incredible story, the rise and fall of Mobutu.
Yes, I mean, it was written after he had fallen, and I didn't know that I had much to add, actually. But I realised that because, you know, Zaire was a Francophone country, there was a lot of that history that maybe wasn't familiar to English-speaking readers. And also, I suppose what I tried to get into that book and what made it fun to write was it wasn't just about Mobutu's story. It was about what's it like to live in a country where there's a predatory state but also an incompetent state. And a state that most people have learnt to avoid, ignore and bypass. And they've managed to retain their sense of humour and humanity. And they've got all these marvellous coping mechanisms. And that was really why I wrote the book. And then I sort of, the Mobutu story was the sort of the classic story that I wove around that. But the bit that interested me was those coping mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And also, and I think it was, I hope it's an upbeat story despite the darkness that's within it. Because, you know, when you live in a place like Zaire, I used to sometimes think that if I wrote a book about Zaire, I was going to call it I Like It Here. Because when I met people, you know, and I was on holiday in the West or something, they would all think I was terribly brave. And you know, oh, my God, it must be so ghastly. I used to think, no, I'm enjoying it. You know, I like it because I'm meeting amazing people and because everyone in that country copes notwithstanding, and that's what's so fascinating about it. Yeah. And it's not a depressing place to live, and I think this is true in so many of those kind of situations.
I'm absolutely fascinated by it, and I always recommend a bundle of books to people. I say that they should start obviously with Heart of Darkness with Conrad, but then they should read King Leopold's Ghost. They should read you. They should read Susan Williams,
Who Killed Doug Hammarskjöld.
Yeah. And they should read Aidan Hartley. But there's such wonderful literature associated with it. Yeah. And just such a rich history. And also, had things worked in a different way, it would have changed the course of Africa and the world as we know it.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is true. I was talking about this with my editor about my new book on Rwanda. And he was saying, you know, your books kind of undermine this whole thesis of historians' thesis, which is that individuals don't matter, that it's processes. You know, larger processes that really matter, and individuals are thrown up by circumstance and driving forces of history. And I think in both Zaire and certainly in Rwanda, I totally disagree, because what you see is the force of the individual and the way in which the characteristics of these key players have had such an important role. And, you know, Mobutu was a very strong personality. And, yeah, if it hadn't been Mobutu, if Patrice Lumumba had lived, who knows what would have happened. But, you know, if Larry Devlin, the CIA station chief, hadn't been posted there, you know, if Patrice had been the next sort of president and had gone, you know, and embraced the Soviet Union, I mean, who knows?
If Hammarskjöld hadn't died.
If Hammarskjöld hadn't died. I mean, someone that we had forgotten about until Susan Williams's book came out, who was an extraordinary man, really interesting.
The second Secretary General of the United Nations.
Yeah. Yes, and who died in that mysterious plane crash, or was it a crash? Probably not. And very strong political views, very progressive, and certainly had his strong opinions on where Central Africa was going.
It feels wrong to kind of skip through your next couple of books. But I want to talk very briefly about your second book, I Didn't Do It For You. And of course, this is about Eritrea, the Red Sea nation of Eritrea. That was an Italian colony, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It was Italy's primogeniture, its first colony. And I think for me, you know, I had this marvelous job at the FT at one stage where I had this traveling brief and I could go pretty much anywhere I wanted to in Africa. And they decided to do an investment survey on Eritrea. So I got to spend a lot of time there, most of it on my own, interviewing minister after minister after minister. I mean, just shows you how things have changed, because the members of that government in the mid to late 90s were so open to journalists and were so happy to talk. Every Eritrean was so happy to talk. And they were so proud of what they had achieved by winning independence. They were rebuilding their nation. Private investment was soaring. You know, you could literally see the buildings going up. And it was a fascinating time to be there. And a very uplifting, exciting story. And I just sort of thought, again, it was one of those stories where you thought, oh my goodness, there's so many interesting chapters. This country has been so intertwined with so many Western, but also, you know, communist societies. So Italy molded it, you know, and then we had the whole stage where Britain was running it. And then there was this whole stage where it was being used as a listening post by the Americans when it was part of Ethiopia. And then there was a whole period of Russian influence when Ethiopia went communist under Mengistu. And these are really fascinating episodes in which, you know, a handful of Western societies have played a role, but they don't even know it. Yeah. Because, of course, we forget this history that we have, you know, so much has happened, you know, that we forget it. So that was a chance to talk about that history and remind people about it. And, you know, the role of Sylvia Pankhurst is very interesting. So she was the sort of daughter of Emmeline Pankhurst, a suffragette, who became an anti-fascist. And because she was an anti-fascist, became outraged by the Italian invasion under Mussolini of Ethiopia. And then became outraged by what she saw the Brits doing after that invasion in terms of asset stripping Eritrea. And, you know, who would have thought that Sylvia Pankhurst, who died in, you know, in Ethiopia and is buried in a cemetery in Addis Ababa. Yeah, so I find these links really interesting.
Do you need to have a little sip of, shall we pour you some fizz before we continue? Because what we're going to talk about next is It's Our Turn to Eat. And this is the story of a Kenyan corruption whistleblower. And it was really very personal to you. I mean, he ended up living in your flat for a while.
Yes. I mean, this is the story of John Githongo, who was a journalist and an anti-corruption activist and somebody I knew, but not that well. And he telephoned me at one stage and he had joined the government of Mwai Kibaki and was supposed to be their anti-corruption czar, as they called it, and had basically stumbled on this massive military procurement scandal called Anglo Leasing, and had then been told to shut up about it, although his job was to investigate corruption, and had been told that by all his colleagues. And he'd just become so appalled by this that he'd ended up taping these conversations. One way or another, taping comes into a lot of my books. It's interesting. And then fled. And he fled while he was in London. He just decided, I'm out of there. And he, you know, turned up with a lot of luggage and basically rang me and said, you know, do you mind if I pop round and stay for a bit? And I was kind of like, no, that's fine. I wasn't expecting it, but sure. And then sort of said, well, I'm sort of on the run. So, and of course, being a journalist at that stage, you think, this is interesting. I wonder if there's a book in this. And eventually, yeah, that became a book.
And a book that did incredibly well. One of The Economist's best books of 2009, shortlisted for the Orwell Prize, optioned for movies and all sorts. Then you took a complete change and you did a novel, Borderlines.
Well, yeah, I mean, like many journalists, we all want to be novelists at heart. And also there was a kind of itch that I wanted to scratch, which was to do with Eritrea, because when I was in the closing stages of finishing my Eritrea book, you know, there had this war with Ethiopia had cropped up the war over the village of Badme. And then there had been, I'd got to know the legal teams that were involved in the arbitration process, because both countries went to arbitration at The Hague. And I got very interested in the arbitration process, in the whole concept of universal justice, international arbitration. And I just wanted to write about that. But I was also aware it was a very dry subject, and that if I wrote a non-fiction book about it, I thought it would just, it would be very niche and would have a tiny audience. And also there was just like a lot of my emotional reaction to Eritrea, which was a place that I really did very much bond with Eritrea when I went there. I mean, if there was any place that infatuated me, I suppose it would be Eritrea. I wanted to come back to that subject somehow. And so I decided to do it in a fictional form and just see if I could do that and use those muscles. And it was really nice to write in that way, because you can explore, you know, more subjective elements. I think a lot of my writing is very fact-based. And there comes a point where you do get a bit fed up of all the fact-checking you have to do and the grounding and, you know, do I have a reference for this? Can I prove that? And there's moments where you think, I know what I think, and there's some subjective experiences I want to convey, and nonfiction can be a bit of a straitjacket. Mm, mm. So that's why I wrote a novel about it.
Let's talk about the next one, right, though, because Do Not Disturb, the story of a political murder in an African regime gone bad. So there is an accepted narrative in the West, which is that Paul Kagame is fantastic.
He ended the genocide,
and he is the man who we must all be behind. But for a while, there's been another story bubbling up, and you finally have been brave enough to expose that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when the genocide happened, I mean, that was the most grotesque chapter in African history for decades. And I think it was therefore normal and not surprising that the journalists and the diplomats and the aid workers who encountered literally piles of bodies left by, you know, Juvenal Habyarimana's army and his militias, the horror of that was so intense that it was not that surprising that the Rwandan Patriotic Front of Paul Kagame, who came in and took power in the end in July 94, they were seen as, oh my God, thank God for these people. They've ended it. They're preaching reconciliation, ethnic reconciliation. They're progressive. They're rebuilding the country. And I think there was always a darker side to that story, and one that I, as a journalist, wasn't particularly aware of, and then gradually became aware of. Like most journalists and diplomats and aid workers. And I think there was an initial reluctance to believe these counter-testimonies and this evidence that sort of went against that picture of the RPF as these white knights coming in, ending the horror. And, and actually these revelations that the RPF had also committed atrocities, mass atrocities, not just small revenge killings, you know, the odd soldier losing control when he discovered his family had been wiped out during the genocide. I mean, it was much more systematic than that.
And supported by the West.
It was supported in terms of, you know, the Kagame's government has had 40% of its operating budget paid by the West ever since. And a lot of these atrocities, revelations of the atrocities, have been covered over and ignored by the West. You know, turned a blind eye to because, well, you know, what do you expect? Turbulent part of the world, rough and tumble, these, you know, very difficult times. But it really, the evidence just mounts up and mounts up. And it's not as though it hasn't been reported. I mean, from dating back to the Gersony report, which was this report that came out in 94, which sort of exposed the real nastiness of what the RPF was doing, to the UN reports into the killings, mass killings of Hutu refugees in Congo. We can't say the evidence isn't there.
Mm. I mean, even recently, United Nations had a report about it. And another one coming up in June, the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. Will they talk about it?
Well, I think the tendency is that Kagame has been such a dominating character, sort of towering character on the African landscape. You know, when Rwanda had the chair of the African Union, he's sort of rebranded Kigali as his conference center. So we sort of African Development Bank meetings there. The African Davos was there. Commonwealth meeting is going to be there in June. And he's a very strong, forceful character. And I think he has branded his country as like a country that you have to pay attention to, and also a country that will not take any lessons from the West or from other countries because it went through the genocide. So he's very adept at using the genocide as a weapon to, you know, further his regime. It's sort of like, you did nothing to stop the genocide, so don't dare lecture us.
The book has had absolutely brilliant advance press. I mean, the blurbs about it are great. And for me, the genius is the way that you focus in on this kind of very small cast of characters. We get to know them. We care what happens to them. And it's never happy. But as you referred to near the beginning, it's about the former head of intelligence.
Yeah, the former head of intelligence, Patrick Karagaya, who I knew. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, I guess we were acquaintances, friendly acquaintances. I'd met him as a journalist. When you went to interview Kagame in Kigali, he would come out to greet you in the lobby and Josh with you. He was a great joker, very convivial, easygoing, very un-Rwandan in that he was approachable. He was foul-mouthed. He liked a beer or two. He had no personal barriers. There was none of that sort of reserve that sometimes you meet with Rwandan officials. So we got to know each other, and then I remember he was a bit, you know, a bit too free with his opinions, maybe. So I remember being not that surprised when I heard that he was in trouble with the regime, he was out of favor. And then I was surprised when I heard he'd fled. And then, you know, I was surprised when I heard he'd set up an opposition movement in exile in South Africa. And then the day, there was this day, the 1st of January, 2014, when I opened my computer and there were all these messages saying, have you heard what's happened to Patrick? And what they were saying, these were friends of mine who had heard that he had been strangled in a South African hotel room in the Michelangelo Hotel by a bunch of Rwandan agents who had lured him there and set him up and killed him. And these were people sent by his old friend, Paul Kagame, who had been his closest, you know, he'd been his éminence grise for decades.
And in the book, of course, you uncover what happened, and you uncover more about really what is, it would seem to me, to be a murderous regime that operates, it would seem, with impunity in other countries. And so I guess my final question to you is, are you not afraid to publish this?
Yes, I am afraid to publish this. I've been afraid ever since I started it. It's been my most frightening book. I think I've been a bit worried about the fallout from all of my books, and they've got progressively more provocative towards powerful states. But this one, I've been describing how people who are in exile and dissidents and are just routinely harassed, intimidated, made to disappear, attacked and bumped off. And you can't interact with those kind of people day in, day out for nearly 5 years and not have some of that fear rub off on you. Because you end up thinking, my God, this has happened to the people I'm interviewing and I'm going to be telling their stories. Obviously, what does that mean about my own safety and security? So I've definitely been much more worried about that. And I'm much more paranoid now than I ever used to be. I take basic precautions. But, you know, like the people I interview, I would never meet a Rwandan in a private place. And I use encrypted emails, and I would never go on WhatsApp. And I know that my emails are probably being read because the Rwandan government's very good at using spyware and hacking into people's accounts. So the paranoia of the people I've interviewed has rubbed off on me. But the experience of writing about that regime for nearly 5 years is that I no longer felt it was paranoia. I felt it was completely reasonable. The fear, the trepidation, their awareness that they were constantly being tracked, that has been borne out by experience. Those people know they're in danger and they're not being hysterics.
Well, I think that everything you've done for this, it's incredibly brave, and not just Rwandans, but people all over the world should be very grateful for you for exposing this, and not least people here in Britain who really need to examine what our overseas department has been doing. Yeah. Michaela, it's a wonderful book. It's called Do Not Disturb, The Story of a Political Murder and an African Regime Gone Bad. And it's published by HarperCollins. Michaela Wrong, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Charlie Filmer Court. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.